The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Catherine Shaw, and before we hear the show, we just wanted to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For more information on building your own beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. Now on with the show.
Stay calm, don't panic, it's another homespun edition of The Guardian Film Show, repelling hordes of bad movies with a twinkle in its eye and an arsenal of tired puns and double entendres. But if you will ask us for a Guardian Film Show, then by God, we'll give you one.
Bravo, Mandarin.
Nice front, shoulders back. Sergeant in the home guard, not a sack of potatoes.
Whisper a movie you've written in secret. Maybe I've even heard of it.
Coming up on this particular show, Bryan Cranston stars as the blacklisted screenwriter of Spartacus in Trumbo. Two estranged Icelandic brothers absolutely positively have to protect their rams.
And then one day, they actually became real. My monsters literally leapt off the page.
And wild-eyed Jack Black writes his demons into being in the kiddie horror Goosebumps. But leading from the front, we have the big screen overhaul of Dad's Army, in which the only thing standing between us and a full-scale Nazi invasion is a bunch of old crocs and flat-footed imbeciles. This is how the war was won.
He's been on the run. He'll be tired and hungry. If you won't come quietly, you know what to do.
There he is, sir.
It's the dog days of World War II, and the heroes of Captain Mannering's Home Guard are feeling the pace. They could use a sit-down, or a trip to the loo, or another jam roly-poly. But dastardly deeds are afoot, and if that weren't enough, here comes Catherine Zeta-Jones's shady reporter to spark an outbreak of lust in the ranks.
Welcome to Wilmington.
I saw that. You just slipped her a sausage.
I'm joined, bayonets at the ready, by Peter Bradshaw and Henry Barnes. Peter, it's cosy, it's jaunty, and watching it, I found myself slightly losing the will to live.
Kind of, yeah, kind of. It's one of those films, I'm really thinking, who's going to want to see it? I mean, I'm really thinking, what is the box office on this movie going to be? Is everybody really going to turn out, even the people like me who have warm, fuzzy memories of the original TV show? It wasn't bad. I mean, it could have gone either way. It's just that the kind of weakness and soppiness of it, it just looks very exposed in a way that it might not have done so much in Paddington, which is the comparable thing, again, written by Hamish McColl. He's a very, very funny, talented writer. And yet there, the kind of slight kind of sogginess was all right in a kind of kids' film. Mm. But if you're looking at something which is notionally targeted at adults, it's not that the gags fall flat. There are lots of very good lines in it, but there are stretches of it when you think, how are we going to stretch this out to 90 minutes? Yeah. How on earth are we going to protract this essential kind of 40-minute TV episode to an hour and a half, or whatever it is.
I speak a little German. One of my nannies was from Leipzig. What's in my dear Zena, mein Engel?
What did you say, Godfrey?
Have you brushed your teeth, my angel?
And there's another factor of why can't we assemble this kind of acting talent and this kind of writing talent for a new film?
Yeah.
I mean, my goodness, imagine that. Imagine a new film with Michael Gambon, Tom Courtney, Toby Jones, all these amazing people. With something new and exciting, but I don't know, Dad's Army. But I'd be genuinely interested to see the box office results for this.
It's not even that it's a faded memory. The Dad's Army sitcom's just on TV constantly, it seems. Mm.
Yeah, it's like making a Friends feature film, I guess. Like, what's the point? Because you can see it everywhere already. I think Toby Jones probably saves it by sheer force of will alone.
You remind me of someone. Winston Churchill.
I like to think that if we met, we'd both be the richer for it.
Oh, yeah.
He's surprisingly good at physical comedy as well, which I haven't really seen him do before. And he channels that kind of angry little man spirit really well, and he's very clever with it. I don't think the script's that terrible. There's a line that Mark Gatiss delivers about Toby Jones's character and him and their wives going for a four ball on the golf course or something, which is kind of rude and crude and silly in a way that Sunday afternoon probably wouldn't accommodate. I think it could have done with more of that.
Yeah.
The big innovation, of course, is bringing the women folk on stage, which was a very big gag, of course, the first time around, that Mrs. Mannering never appeared on stage. She was sort of indoors. And even Pike's mum, I think, only had a very small role.
Wonderful sight. Man and woman united in common cause.
Whatever you say, dear.
It's a little twist on it, and it doesn't make any difference at all.
Yeah.
And you have to congratulate it on making no difference at all to the franchise product. A franchise product that we didn't know we wanted. I mean, that's what it comes down to in the end.
What Peter was saying about bringing the female characters into the forefront, I wonder if that wasn't a mistake, actually, because Dad's Army itself is about a gang of older men who are hiding from reality.
Yes. Right?
They're hiding from responsibility and their wives, and painting themselves as heroes at a time when there were real heroes out there. And that kind of, I don't know, social club mentality is interesting and would make for a kind of a low-key comedy. But this is, it's just kind of doing the worst thing that you do with sitcoms, which is blowing them into the stratosphere and hopefully trying to take the pieces back and stitch it into something coherent. It just doesn't work.
I'll catch him, sir. What does he look like?
We don't know, Frank. That's rather the point with spies.
Stupid boy.
The hardy heroes of Dad's Army ensuring that England can sleep soundly. Moving swiftly on, we come to another period tale in Trumbo, spotlighting a shabby slice of Hollywood history. And it looks like this.
Your next deal is going to make you the highest paid writer in Hollywood, which will make you the highest paid writer in the world. Where do I sign?
Communism is not some faraway threat. Its most dangerous agents are here in Hollywood. They need to be identified as the enemies they are.
Bryan Cranston is Dalton Trumbo, a leftist screenwriter in 1950s LA, targeted by the authorities and shunned by his colleagues. Now Trumbo's out in the cold, stuck on the blacklist, and scheming to write himself back into contention with a fog of cigarette smoke and a clatter of typewriter keys. Henry, it's a fascinating, meaty story, this, but I wondered, ironically, whether the script quite does it justice.
I'm not sure it does. I think you're right. I think Hollywood's pretty bad at self-analysis in recent years. You've got things like Argo and The Artist, and this is actually in that vein. There's a little bit of Hollywood saying, we did wrong, this is our fault, and let's try and rectify it. But there's also an awful lot of self-congratulatory, we're amazing, can't we fix the day? Which, you know, given the current state of affairs in terms of the Oscars so white furore and the fact that the industry is now finally admitting it has a diversity problem, it probably isn't great to have films coming out saying we're marvellous and we really help the people that have been repressed and suppressed all these years. It's clearly not true. Bryan Cranston is good in this, but he gives what we used to call a TV performance before TV got great, partly because of Cranston, ironically enough. I think he's very strong in it, but it just feels like a by-the-numbers biopic.
Kind of transparent and tacky and weirdly lit and blocked.
Very
it looked like daytime soap at
times. It really does. Yeah. And also they have this weird thing of playing up Trumbo's mannerisms into eccentricity. So things like him typewriting in the bath or smoking with a cigarette holder. It just throws the drama out the window. There's a scene where he's strip searched before he goes into jail, and Cranston's so busy gurning away and doing these kind of Trumboisms. It feels like a bad knockabout comedy rather than a very serious moment in this guy's life when he's been jailed for writing what he wanted to write.
What did you make of it?
I broadly agree. I thought it was a kind of heartfelt film, very stolid, slightly TV movie-ish, with some good performances and some not so good performances. I, on the whole, however mannered, I like Bryan Cranston. He kind of carried it. And I like Michael Stuhlbarg's Edward G. Robinson. I thought he was very good.
And Dino Gorman looks at splitting in
impersonation of Kirk Douglas. I have to say, I didn't like Helen Mirren doing her Wicked Witch of the West routine. I thought that was pretty awful. But it is a valuable reminder of an extraordinary period in American public life when a writer could go to prison for his political beliefs. The only thing I would say, I this is a kind of hobby horse of mine, is there's one trick that it seriously misses. Surely the most important lines that Dalton Trumbo ever wrote in his life were, "I'm Spartacus." Famously, that was his invention. It didn't happen in history. It didn't happen in the source novel. He invented it. It was a vision, a compelling vision of solidarity, the sort of solidarity that he wanted and never got. Yeah. He wanted everybody else in Hollywood to say, "I'm Spartacus," and to back him up, and nobody did. Mm. And this movie blows it. It doesn't mention it. Does everybody
Why
in this bowl...
Isn't that so glaringly obvious?
Surely. I mean, they go on a little bit about Spartacus, how obviously the slave rebel is something to do with Dalton Trumbo. I mean, so I think that was a trick missed.
Phone for you.
Oh, who is it?
Kirk Douglas.
I'm doing a new picture about one man who tried to take on the whole world.
So in terms of Hollywood's response to this now, there's the fact that Cranston has an Oscar nomination for this. Does that amount to a kind of mea culpa?
Well, I don't think so. I think Cranston's probably due an Oscar nomination, you know, and I think that's to do with his individual performance. I think this is a shame on Hollywood. This whole story is a black mark on Hollywood's history.
Oh, yeah.
And they're having a real trouble facing up to that and facing up to current issues in the industry as well.
It's easy
I don't think that
kind of
can be understated.
For stuff that was 50 years ago.
It really is. And it has the Argo disease of the Argo fuck yourself thing of... Somehow, the film about what's happening in Argo, the B-movie that they concoct in order to get the people out of the situation in Iran, is more important somehow than the Iranians or Iran or the people that are trapped in the embassy in that film. Mm. And with this, the comedy mannerisms, the light tone, the watchability of it overtake anything to do with the importance of the story itself. And it's just a fatal mishandling in that way. It might be to do with shame, it might be to do with awkwardness, but you can't excuse losing the drama, I guess, in all of that.
Fire Dalton Trumbo. We will put you right out of business.
I don't think you and me are going to be pals.
That's Bryan Cranston bringing the house down as Trumbo. High time we kicked all that Hollywood tinsel off our boots and lit out for the wilds of Iceland and the simple life of the sheep farmer. Although it turns out there's trouble there too. Bachelor brothers Gummy and Kiddy occupy neighbouring farms in the Icelandic interior, eyeballing each other across a wire fence. But the farms are in crisis, the sheep all have scrapie, and the enemy next door may be an ally in disguise. Peter, I think we need more films from Iceland. We had Of Horses and Men a couple of years ago,
sort
which is really good. And this is great as well.
Kind of amazing how the drama kind of emerges from this fascinating landscape, which is, like that previous film, shot so eloquently and so beguilingly. Mm. I really enjoyed this. Mm. I thought this is the kind of movie that Paul and Pressburger might have made in a previous era. I like the fact that I was never sure what kind of a movie it was going to be. Is it a comedy? Mm. Is it a tragedy? Mm. Is it a drama? I'm genuinely not sure. And I was really absorbed by it. I thought the performances were very good. They were very easy, accessible and naturalistic. I wondered towards the end where we were going with it, to be honest with you. I think it's got a very powerful image. Mm. The last image. It's got a very big finish. I wondered whether I entirely bought it, but as a dramatic punch, it's very, very effective. Mm. So yeah, I mean, I found it real kind of organic, non-GM filmmaking.
Yeah.
I mean, it really a real storytelling piece of a real storytelling kind of bravura stuff. There is one moment of farce where somebody has to get hit over the head with a shovel. And I thought, you know, now where are we going? But what a remarkable film. It's a classic kind of festival fave in a way. It's a sort of film that gets real play on international festivals. Everybody talks about it.
And then nobody
goes to see it. I hope people will go and see it because it's a lovely film in many ways.
I mean, one thing that can be said about a film is that it takes you somewhere that you didn't really know existed and really immerses you in it. This totally does that.
Yeah, it does do that. I mean, although this kind of strange rural world that we as city types are not aware of and the small societies act in them have been done quite a lot recently. Things from, I keep saying it, but Bullhead. And this, and then, as you said, Of Horses and Men. It did remind me a little bit tonally of Roy Anderson a teeny bit.
Yes.
In that it's, as you say, teetering on the edge between comedy and horror, and you're never sure whether
it's supposed to laugh or feel appalled. Yeah, that kind of vein of absurdity.
Yeah, and I love that. I really like that idea that it's not prescriptive about how you're supposed to be feeling at any particular time. I think part of the tone and why it works is this guy, I'm going to murder his name, Sturla Brand Gurian, who is the cinematographer, who also shot this film Victoria, which was a one-take... Yeah. Two-hour one-take bank heist thriller,
And which is at Toronto.
That's really good, and he just expertly kind of manages to give you this idea of a small community that only sees itself, but is somehow the world at the same time. And you're stuck in these dark rooms with these guys talking about scrapie, and it becomes the most important thing in the world to you. Yeah, and that's the whole point of this, right? That small communities can breed huge stories, and it's good because of that.
bearded brothers, lock horns in the excellent Rams. Just time for one last film, although fortunately it does feature Jack Black. Here he is as the creator and victim of Goosebumps.
These are all Goosebumps manuscripts. Why are these books locked? Did you unlock a book?
Oh no,
I'm sorry. I'll put it back where it belongs. Look, here it is. Look.
No, don't open it!
Teens Zach and Hannah open the Goosebumps books at their peril. Inside lurk all manner of CGI monsters and ghouls. And suddenly, hey presto, the whole town is overrun by the abominable snowman, a slobbering werewolf, and some murderous gnomes. It's left to Jack Black to close the books with a snap.
Not friendly. Definitely not friendly.
Hen, I wasn't able to see this one, but it looks a little ropey. Maybe you can correct me.
Not quite as ropey as you would think. I like Jack Black. I've liked him since High Fidelity, and I thought he was great in Bernie. But
have you ever seen Jesus' Son?
No,
he's really good in that.
Is he great in that?
He's brilliant.
But there's nobody that looks so energised on screen and seems so bored at the same time. He really is just doing this kind of manic, crazy guy stuff in his sleep now. It's an interesting premise that doesn't go far enough. So basically, he plays R.L. Stine, the author. So it's very meta.
Yeah.
And he's doing lots of kind of jibes about Stephen King, how he sold 400... R.L. Stine sold 400 million copies worldwide. Why isn't he more recognised? Yeah. But to buy into that, you have to buy into the idea implicitly that R.L. Stine is such a good writer that his stories leap from the page and will become literally real life and life-threatening, right? And I'm a big fan of R.L. Stine when I was a kid. He's not that good a writer for a start, and this movie is quite a big fluff piece to his talent and to his grandiosity, I guess. It's fun. It zips along. The kids are kind of boring and vanilla in a kind of corn-fed American way. There's a very strange ending where the female character gets very much underdone and almost horribly sexually treated in a strange way that you can't go into. I don't know. There's something about it that just doesn't go far enough. It's not horrible enough. It's not funny enough. Jack Black doesn't seem active enough. And I just kind of got a bit bored halfway through it.
I mean, talking about audiences, I mean, the YA fiction audience is vast, but do they necessarily go to the movies to see films like this?
I don't know. This is surely pitched at a younger audience than that. I mean, this is like tweeny audiences rather than YA. I can see it playing rather well. I mean, I quite enjoyed this. I really know nothing at all about R.L. Stine and the Goosebumps series. I know zero about it. I thought it was funny when he gets into this cross thing about Stephen King. He says, I sold 400 million. You mean domestic? No, worldwide, but it's still very impressive.
I could have killed you!
That was a terrible throw.
There is a potentially kind of dark or even sort of slightly poignant thing going on with his romantic interest, which we can't go into, which is a sort of problem that the film rather airily solves at the end. Having told us that this is a rather poignant thing, the film effectively says, actually, don't bother being sad about it because we've decided actually that's a little bit too sad.
Presumably, I mean, it's done quite well in the States, so presumably this is going to be the first of a number of these.
They do suggest that there could be room for a sequel. God knows. I think where the young adult stuff that works well works, like The Hunger Games, for example, is where they're not afraid of being too adult. So, you have genuine horror in The Hunger Games. It's actually quite frightening. This is very much more bubblegum poppy, and there's nothing wrong with that as such. It's just it doesn't really commit to that either.
And the fact that it has every single one of his stories, characters, is brought onto the screen seems to kind of render completely useless the idea of a sequel.
Like it's as if
it's
bolts.
It's totally shot its bolt, surely. I mean, I think that was my problem with it, is that it was so diffuse and so unfocused and so undisciplined, because it just throws everything, every single kind of beastie monster that he's ever supposed to have invented is chucked into the mix. I would have thought that would have ruled out a sequel. I certainly would have hoped so, because basically I think this hadn't outstayed its welcome for me, but it certainly, I didn't want it to go on any longer.
I'm okay. I'm still okay.
Flesh and Blood, Jack Black in the CGI Goosebumps. And that's about it from us. All that remains to say is that on February the 25th, we're shooting a special Oscar preview edition of the Guardian Film Show down at the Picture House Central in London. So you can buy a ticket, come along, and see how all this seamless magic is really created. Apologies in advance for that. Also, to point out that the Dailies Film Podcast goes out every day, rounding up the day's film news of the day. In the meantime, my thanks to Peter and to Henry. We're back in the studio, same time next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.